Welcome to University Drive, your pathway to the transformational work of University of the Bahamas. Our goal is to build a better Bahamas by shaping tomorrow's leaders today, finding solutions to challenges, and forging new opportunities for growth. University Drive, where faculty, staff, students, and alumni travel the road of progress together with you. Hello, everyone, and welcome to University Drive. I'm your host, Tamika Lundy. Today, we confront truths that cannot be ignored. The year 2024 is on track to become the hottest in recorded history. For the first time, global warming may surpass a critical threshold. Coral reefs, the jewels of our oceans, are fading, and extreme weather events are battering our islands with increasing ferocity. Here in the Bahamas, where 80% of our land lies less than 1.5 meters above a rising sea level, the danger is no longer on the horizon. It's on our doorstep. This week, the world's eyes turn to the International Court of Justice. Speaking before the ICJ, Attorney General Ryan Pinder reminded us that international law has the power to shape the destiny of nations. In a time of global crisis, how can the law hold countries accountable and ensure justice for all, especially those most vulnerable? In this episode, we're delving into the stakes, the challenges, and the hope that still remains in this pivotal moment for the Bahamas and the world. The youth voice in climate action is a game changer. Joining us are representatives of the organization, the World's Youth for Climate Justice, UB Biology with Chemistry major Ashante Russell, the Caribbean Front Coordinator, and Samira Ben Ali, Outreach and Engagement Coordinator. Thank you both for joining us here on University Drive.
Thank you so much for having us.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
I am so glad that you're both here, and I'm excited about the conversation that I know that we will all have. Firstly, tell us a little bit about the World's Youth for Climate Justice. What does it seek to do and why? What's its mission?
So the World Youth for Climate Justice is an organization that has been brought up partly by students from the Pacific, but also by students from outside, from around the world. And the aim was climate justice. That was the big aim. But the tool that we wanted to use to be able to bring climate justice at an international level is the process of advisory opinions that are specifically talking about climate change. So right now, one of the main advisory opinions we're working on is, of course, the one that is at the International Court of Justice, but we are also following the one that happened at the Tribunal of the Law of the Sea, and also the one that is happening at the Inter-American Court of Human Rights. So yes, those are like some of the tools that we're trying to use to bring climate justice from a legal perspective.
Okay, and Samira, how does your role seek to ensure that those aims are fulfilled? What are you focused on specifically in your role?
So as an outreach and engagement coordinator, I'm working at the global level, and I'm also part of the steering committee. Basically, what I do is that I'm trying to build partnership and use those partnership in a way that is making sense in the campaign. I think that the campaign has been built upon the partnership that we have had so far. It's because more than 1,000 CSOs have been supporting this campaign, that they have signed and showcased in the document that, yes, we are following this campaign and we're encouraging it, that actually it has been able to be pushed at this level. So our partnership at all level, whether it's international, regional, or national, have been some of the most meaningful and most impactful things for us to be able to push this campaign to the place it has been going right now.
Okay, all very important work. And Ashante, you've been in the environmental advocacy space for quite some time now. What specifically do you do in your role that you hold?
So thank you so much. So within my capacity, one of the driving forces that we do within the Caribbean Front is establishing our specific competency within the focus of the global organization. So we officially established the Caribbean Front last year. And since then, we've been slowly but surely building ourselves as a representation of the organization by connecting the Caribbean region through climate justice. So currently, we are, for lack of a better word, battling the vices of colonialism. And that's been one of the issues that has continuously segmented our region, because so much of the time when you think about the Caribbean, you think primarily about the English-speaking territories and countries, and by extension, the Spanish-speaking countries. But a lot of the individuals, even within the region, don't realize we have French-speaking territories or Dutch-speaking territories. So in one part, we're supporting the campaign and inserting ourselves as a definite and really and truly important, I guess I could say, resource within the conversation, because one, we are vulnerable as small islands, and it's another reason for us to be as collaborative and as connected as possible with our other regional friends, because we represent the same premise. It's just we're using our unique and specific focuses to maximize our global campaign.
Okay, increasing the momentum and the impact of the work that you do by establishing collaborative coalitions. Yes?
Yes, ma'am.
Very good. All right, so you both are at The Hague right now at this very moment. Paint the picture for us. Tell us about the activities happening and the sentiments that are being expressed around you.
I think that there's a lot of excitement around us. This campaign and the hearings in particular have been a long time coming. We have come a really long way after like 4 years of campaigning heavily. So this is also for us an important moment where we're able like to reunite and to convene together with people from the team that are part like that are spread around the world. So that in that sense it's really joyful. But on a personal level, I also feel the importance of this moment for the future. Because I tell myself that if we're able actually to get a good advisor opinion out of this, then maybe we can use it really strongly to advocate at other levels. So a sense of responsibility also towards the future.
And Ashanti, from your perspective?
Yes, so far it's been an amazing experience. A lot of the conversations that I would have been privy to today in particular, because today is actually my first official day following the proceedings, aside from the Caribbean and a few of the Pacific Island submissions prior to. But today there was a heavy focus on Indigenous cultures and Indigenous knowledge. And for me, it resonates even strongly knowing that in the Bahamas, we really don't have an Indigenous observation. We were more so connected to our heritage because of our ecosystems, but we don't have a people's presence. So being in the room and hearing individuals speak so passionately about not just losing their livelihoods, not just losing their environmental culture, but losing so much resources in people and in practice and in customary traditional laws and focuses. It really and truly resonates strongly and gives me an additional sense of responsibility, because I know what it is to have that disconnect with my environment. I know what it is to not necessarily have that correlation in real time. And the last thing that I would really want for other nations that have that premise is to lose that, because it will literally be an amputation, and the phantom pains from that, they're inconceivable and you cannot recover from it. So this specific hearing, this specific these meetings are more important than individuals realize, because if things go as we really and truly hope, we stand to change a tide that has been building for years. And I'm looking forward to being able to see that to its end.
You know, sitting here listening to you both, I can hear a sense of urgency. Are you feeling that there's that same sense of urgency in the conversations that are happening around you, or even are you detecting that in the work that you are doing normally? Are you detecting that the world is getting it?
Slowly but surely, I do agree. In a lot of countries, we've definitely seen the driving force of them coming to the realization that this is something that must be spoken of, must be addressed, because climate change is no longer just an issue that has been on the shores of frontline states or states that are mainly coastal or oceanic, it's began to represent and present itself in different fashions and facets around the world. And it's become, for lack of a better word, harder to ignore. And while there are still individuals, parties, and countries that contest or seek loopholes in the discussion, it's undeniable that a great portion of the world is currently being impacted, has been impacted, or will soon be impacted. So it's not a matter of if climate change exists in certain countries, it's a matter of when it's going to become so much of a large issue that they can no longer ignore it, they can no longer deny it. So we've definitely seen the urgency from various states, various regions, various countries, and we're hoping for the broadest possible acceptance coming out of this hearing, because it'll help us to address not just the most vulnerable among us, but those that will stand to join that specific grouping in short order.
Samira, do you feel the same way?
Yes, definitely. I do feel the same way. Somehow, I also feel like it's dependent on who you're talking to. When you're talking to people that we're some of our partners that we have been working with, most of them being from the global south, I think that for them, the climate change is actually a reality. People are being relocated. People are losing their home. They're losing their practical tradition. So I think that in a sense we can already see it happen. And so the sense of urgency is based on reality. But for others, especially some of the state delegation that we've been able to talk to, or some of the hearings that we've been able to have. Just yesterday we had hearings from the United States, but also Russia, who were admitting to some extent the climate realities, but still were not really providing an exposé that was in that sense, that was actually acknowledging within the law that sense of urgency. So I think it's really depends. And also, I think that sometimes as climate activists, we live in this kind of like climate bubble. So when we are in that bubble, we're all in agreements with each other. Like, yes, of course, this is happening. These are the facts, and this is what is going to happen if we do nothing in the next few years. But as soon as we go a little bit outside, sometimes I feel like I clash with another form of reality that is completely different from mine. So yeah, it's definitely depend on who you're talking to, but. At least from our islands, I'm also from an island that is called Mayotte, from just next to Madagascar. We can see it happening, and we can see a sense of urgency because we see centimeter by centimeter our islands being, you know, engulfed by the sea.
And Samira, your country is where?
So my where I'm from is called Mayotte. It's an overseas territory of France, and it's just next to Madagascar.
What are you seeing? What is your country experiencing?
So, of course, climate change is always multifaceted. It's not only one thing, but and Mayotte is definitely that. One of the heavy crises that we're living right now is actually a water crisis. There has been a huge drought since 2016. So because of that drought, what it's raining, instead of like raining for 5 months and us being able to like restock water in some of the lakes that we have, we are not able to that, do that anymore. And because of that, we're obligated to ration the water that we have. So some days, some villages are going to get water, and some other days they will not. And when it's like at the worst point of the drought, sometimes you have several days where you don't have water. You need to go and buy water. And most of the time, the people up the prices. So it's also really expensive, while Mayotte is also one of the poorest. It is the poorest department of France. 70% of people in Mayotte are living under the poverty line of France. So it's not affordable to be able to buy water. Other aspect that we see is that Mayotte is surrounded by a coral reef barrier, and this coral reef is one of big source also of livelihood of people because we fish there. But now, with the ocean heat rising, we see more ocean acidification happening with the coral, and all coral are being impacted. So I was actually reading a report from the IUCN saying that if nothing is done within that region of the Indian Ocean in the next 50 years, those coral reefs are going to collapse. So this will mean a huge loss of livelihood, but also some of the traditions that are related to the sea that we have on the island. And of course, other things like cyclones that are becoming more violent, more frequent, and all of the things that are touching us as islanders, sea level rise. So yeah.
Samira, what you're describing for me is, in my view, a crisis. And the Bahamas, too, the crisis that the world is in is not lost on us here in the Bahamas as a small island nation as well. And so it's interesting that you both referred to the climate reality. My question is, how do we establish broadly and globally and internationally what is the climate reality that we are facing when we have some of the world's most powerful and influential people who have been expressing doubt about the state of affairs? How do we bridge that gap? What do we do?
I think one of the first things that we wholeheartedly need to come to terms with is being both transparent and accountable. I feel like these are two words that float around in this space and carry at times a negative connotation because individuals look at being transparent as being vulnerable, and those two words are not interchangeable. Being transparent and being accountable gives rise to conversation and lowers the inhibitions of defensiveness. A lot of the times when we get into these spaces and we have these conversations, the earnest is upon nations to focus on their backyards. That is their primary concern. However, we must take into consideration that we exist in a global community. This is a global issue. This is not one that is unique to the Bahamas or unique to Grenada or unique to any developed nation. This is one that kind of extends. It's multilateral, it's multi-generational, it's global. And for us to wholeheartedly have conversations that lead to action rather than acknowledgement, which has been our global forte for years, acknowledging the issue, talking about the same issue, and then 30 years later, we bring up the same conversation topic again and again. So it's moving away from kicking the proverbial can from generation to generation, because at some point, we're not just going to hit a wall. We're going to hit an impasse that we cannot come back from. And looking at it from a global perspective and looking at it from how we can be progressive going forward, that is the one of the main things we need to do. We need to be more open to each other's realities and understanding that, yes, this has impacted you. And yes, I understand that this is something that will impact you, but not negating another country's experience. And that is one of the reasons a lot of the times when we talk about the global south and the global north, we have decided to remove the connotation of the word versus, because a lot of the times, especially in youth negotiations, it's always the global north youth and then the global south youth. So over the years, we've began to reshape those conversations and look at each other's like partners in the conversation, because until we give every opportunity for respect and mutualism, we will continue to look at each other like adversaries in one collective fight that really and truly belongs to no nation alone. So removing the negative emotions attached to being transparent, to being accountable, and looking at accountability as an extension of responsibility and transparency as an extension of being collaborative. It gives us the opportunity to do better and to be better.
And Samira, how do we establish those climate realities as baseline facts that we cannot deny?
I also completely agree with Ashante, but I must also say that part of the answer is on the work that we're actually doing with Ashante, with the World Youth for Climate Justice, and by making sure that countries that have been trying to deny those realities, or at least to put them aside for those who are the most vulnerable, are confronted with their responsibility and their obligation. So they must be confronted with the fact that some of them have historic responsibility. And that must be, if that is established by the highest court in the world, then it's going to be harder for them to escape that reality because it have been more established as a form of consensus. So I would say that making sure that this is enshrined within international law and at the highest level possible, and described in as many terms as possible within all the confines of international law, will be a big first step toward going that way and making sure that actually this is a reality that has been accepted at all front and at all level.
Okay, here is where we take our first break of the show. You're listening to University Drive. We're talking about climate change and a very important advisory opinion that is pending from the International Court of Justice. We'll be back after this.
Are you ready to make a lasting impact in healthcare? University of the Bahamas is now accepting applications for its brand new Master of Science in Nursing program. With specialized tracks in nursing education, nursing administration, public community health, and adult gerontology, courses will be offered using a blended modality of online and face-to-face. Master advanced skills in patient care, dive into evidence-based practice, and become a leader in health policy. Get hands-on experience working with industry experts and tackling complex healthcare challenges, all with the confidence and compassion that nursing demands. The deadline to apply for the Master of Science in Nursing is January 17, 2025, but get an early start and apply today. Visit ub.edu.bs for the application form. Applications are now open for public community health and nursing education. Call 397-2601 or 397-2602 or email graduate@ub.edu.bs for more information. Classes begin on March 3rd, 2025.
Here we are back on University Drive. Thank you very much for listening and staying tuned and locked in. We are speaking with Ashante Russell and also Samira Ben Ali, both from the World's Youth for Climate Justice organization. They are at The Hague, where the ICJ is considering an advisory opinion on climate change. Tell us, what is the power of an advisory opinion from the International Court of Justice? Explain that to us.
So first of all, the ICJ is often described as the highest court in the world, and we have more than 190 states that are part of it and are following the process of the ICJ that go toward the ICJ when they need clarification about the law, but also when they want to, you know, fight each other or at least deal with some dispute that they may have. So this is a trusted place, a trusted entity at an international level that holds a lot of weight. And when it gives an advisory opinion, which is basically a clarification of a legal question that people have, that advisory opinion is not something that is binding, that's not something that's going to force states to do something, but still at an international level, it holds a lot of weight, a lot of moral weight, a lot of legal weight, and it can be used after that to shape international law coming from that. But if you want to add anything, also.
No, I wholeheartedly agree. It's an entity that gives right to rights, in a sense. It gives the opportunity for states to make their claim, to make their grievances known and a space for them to be heard. Which is why we were honestly so happy that Vanuatu's case was accepted. Because for us, especially as small islands, that was a representative stance. Because similarly to the Pacific Islands, we struggle with a lot of the same vices. Land entrenchment has been one of the major issues that we've been observing and watching in the Bahamas especially. And we've seen the maps of what Nassau in particular, Nassau New Providence, will look like in the next 50 years. And looking at the map, but then seeing that happening to countries currently, it further expands the reality of what climate change poses to small islands and what they will eventually pose to coastal and landlocked cities. So having a space and having a place where individuals can have these life-threatening conversations heard and actually have something applicable attached to it is both encouraging as well as a necessity.
So this is an historic moment for the world. How could the ICJ's opinion affect future international climate change talks, for instance, like the ones held at COP conference or the party conferences? What do you think?
It of course depends on what the ICJ will actually say,
True.
but the fact that first this opinion is happening, there was like a first attempt done by Palau. I think it was in 2011, and so that first was not accepted because it was asking a question that was not considered as legal. So this shows that there has been like an evolution in the law and an evolution in the needs of states in general, in terms of like the climate regime and understanding it, what it means. So this particular advisory opinion could shape international law by giving strong guidance on what state actually must do. For example, we have been saying with the BASCOP, this one in Baku or the other ones before, that most of the time, a lot of countries from the global south have their needs and climate reality being denied at international negotiation table. So I was to I have been to COP this year in Baku, and where I was able to discuss with several some states, but also some representative of constituency of the UNFCCC. And some of them were already asking question about how to use the advisory opinion. And for example, Indigenous people constituency were asking, okay, maybe how we can already start to like maybe use the result of the ICG AO to be able to defend our own rights. Some who are representative of more of a just transition were also thinking about, oh, how can we use this? So I think that this particular advisory opinion will be a good way to guide people to make sure that states remain as ambitious as possible to protect their rights. And in particular, if this advisory opinion goes as far as looking not only at the climate regime, but also other regime like customary international law, human rights law, and try to really make sure that all forms of international law are looked at in their applicability from the lens of climate change, then it can be really something powerful in guiding negotiations and policies.
You know, the fact that we have an organization called the World's Youth for Climate Justice is intriguing to me. For me, it is an affirmation of what the world needs, which is the youth voice to be involved and the youth imagination to be applied. But it also is a call to action for climate justice. But what is climate justice?
When I think about climate justice, we often look at it as an amalgamation of human rights and environmental law and justice. And when I say that, I mean a lot of, especially in islands, for us, we realize that as countries, we are the byproduct of our environment as well as the customs that have been passed down. So for us, climate justice is not just securing homes or securing tangible property like cars and buildings, for example. It means if I decide that I want to go outside and for some reason pull sorcery off of a bush and boil it, I have the right and the ability to do so. It means if I decide that I want to go free diving for conchs on a Saturday morning in cold water for some reason, I have the opportunity to do so. It means preserving people, planet, and profit, and striking a unique and holistic balance between the three. So much of the time, in the name of development, we negate one of these P's, and it's almost always planet, and our justification for profit is people. Until we get to the understanding that these three entities must work holistically for us to truly have environments that are one, protected, respected, and preserved, we will continue to have issues with climate change. And so long as we ignore a part of the holistic experiences of people, we will have clashes with climate justice. We can't have environmental activism. We can't have environmental justice. We can't have human rights and human rights observations without taking into the fact that any entrenchment or impediment on any of these conversations is a violation of climate rights and justice.
Yes, I completely agree also with Ashanti. For me, climate justice means protection of the most vulnerable, whether those are humans that also have been historically discriminated and that we know are going to be even more vulnerable and more put aside by the effect of climate change. So those will not have recourses to be able to protect their rights. So that's when climate justice is coming in. But also, it means the protection of the vulnerable that are not able to actually speak for themselves, like lands, seas, and all those kind of entities that come with our surroundings and with the places that we live. Some of us have huge connection to those entities, to those lands. So climate justice means also trying to make sure that we take all necessary measures to protect them too, and make sure that their rights, because for a lot of us, they have rights too, their rights are protected.
Are you both still hopeful that the world will get it right, do what it takes in order to save our planet? And do you, if you are hopeful, is that sense of hope something that the other representatives in your organization also hold?
So within our organization, we call ourselves urban optimists. So that's something that we carry with us. So I think that, yes, we're really driven by optimism and hope, and by the idea that if we just go as people, we assemble together and we go and do our best, then maybe something will change, and really maybe climate ambition will be seen and understood. But I must say that for me, on a personal level, it's also depend on the day. There are days where I'm telling myself, oh wow, I'm seeing the, you know, reports, the scientific reports, I'm seeing the news, and I'm just telling myself there is so much to do. And with climate change, it's, you have to do everything everywhere that needs to be rebuilt, rethought, reconstructed. So I tell myself there's so much and so little willingness sometimes from our political leaders that sometimes I lose that hope. But every time that I'm surrounded by people like I'm here in The Hague, that are activists and that understand deeply within their bones what we need to do, then I have that hope back again, and I find comfort through them.
To add on, I wholeheartedly agree. It does sometimes depend on the day, especially when maybe on a Monday I begin with a certain level of tenacity and I try to meet, or I am in a meeting with a representative from a different state, and the premise used against us as young people is the fact that we are young people. And sometimes that can really, really be disheartening, because not only should we have a seat at the table, we are literally the conduit between current and future generations. So if there's any grouping of people that should be factored into these dialogues, it's us. And we already know that, again, living in the climate bubble, it's already a very interesting place to be. We walk the fence very frequently, I realize, because on one side, we're talking to other young people, and the conversation is sometimes perceived as gloom and doom. And this, again, is something that is not unusual. Climate anxiety is real. It's a real issue, especially amongst Caribbean youth, and talking to them and them hearing, why should I fight or why should I advocate if the numbers are not leaning in my favor? And again, that is where the real premise of being a stubborn optimist comes into play, because it's trying despite, believing despite, doing despite. Because the minute you stop, you literally give way to the worst possible outcome. Personally, I truly believe that I know that things could get worse, but again, that's not a definite. I know that there's a possibility, regardless of how small it might seem, depending on the day, that things can and will turn out okay, that things will go in the direction that we need to not only preserve ourselves on the map, which is something that has been a concern, but in order to do so alongside like-minded young people. Again, coming every time I go to a steering meeting, rather, or coming to a different engagement, I get a newfound sense of energy, because starting off on a Monday and hearing a lot of different responses, and then going to that meeting on Wednesday and being reminded as to, okay, this is why I'm doing this, these are people that I can actually lean on and seek support from, it gives me the energy to get through Thursday and Friday. So I guess to sum it off, working in this space is a very unique experience, but again, it's a privilege and one that is necessary because we're not always given that space that we need to advocate and to acknowledge. And there are too many young people that are not afforded the same opportunity. So I look at it as a chance to really and truly address and present the voices of those that are not in the room, because if you're not present, you're almost always left behind.
You both are in that environmental activism space where there's a lot of talk, a lot of crucial conversations, right? Back and forth. How can citizens help close the gap between talk and action, particularly our young people?
I think that part of the answer is actually we, as people who are part of this bubble again, we also need to make sure that older people who maybe don't know or don't understand as much feel included. I think that we have like a real work to do to try to simplify things, or at least to make them understandable at all levels of from beginners to the environmental movement, to those who are experts who maybe need less of that. But I think that part of the responsibility is making sure that people understand and that they can relate on a personal level, so that actually they can feel engaged and they can feel the need to be part of the movement. So to me, from my understanding of things, we have also a lot of work to do on that sense. And I think that also on the other side, I think people, because now climate change, I think people all have heard about it. So it's also being able to, for those who are not able to join the movement, I think it's come from fear too, of well, because when you really understand what is happening, then it can like really do something within you. And sometimes you just decide to ignore it to be able to deal with it. So I think that being able to do that work of acknowledging whatever is stopping you from taking that into consideration is also something that needs to be done on the other side. But yeah.
I agree with every aspect of what Samira just said, especially in the understanding gap. One of the approaches that I've applied in going forward, and especially when working with young people, is one of Stephen Covey's 7 Habits for Healthy People: seeking first to understand, then to be understood. I realize, again, there is a notable technocrat gap that exists in the space. And science is intimidating, especially, and science with law, that is a very intimidating conversation. And the way that we kind of can present within that bubble, especially because there's so much information, sometimes it is a rapid fire of highly technical and very, very weighted jargon that will literally roll off of one's brain. So it is, the earnest is in part upon us to approach people in the way that they understand, knowing our audience and tailoring our message accordingly. And it's something we've definitely had to do in the Caribbean front a lot this past year, because we've opened our network to youth from, I think, the youngest person in one of our engagements was maybe 3. She was 3 and a half. She did correct me.
Three.
She was 3 and a half. And we had to pres and in that particular meeting, we had a range. So the youngest person was 3, the oldest person was maybe 65. So we had to literally present it in a way that the smallest among us could understand. And it didn't take away from the seriousness or the urgency of the message. If anything, we recruited one of our most bold campaigners this year, and I'm very happy about that. But again, it's understanding where the gaps are and being as patient and as open to the conversations. Because again, this, for a lot of people, though they have seen the changes, like we see the sea rising, we can feel the summer's getting hotter. In the Bahamas, we can truly feel the summer's getting hotter. And we know that we have to go further and further out for certain fisheries. So it's not something that they have been ignoring, to put it simply. It's just something that they may not have a word for. So it's providing those tools, providing those particular terms, but providing it in a way that they can, one, understand it, and being able to understand it and see themselves in that conversation, they're more open to accepting this is the reality, but this is not where we have to stay. And acceptance is not just throwing in the towel. And that's another conversation we had to have with a lot of young people, because when they go through what we like to call at this point, all stages of grief, and they come to the part where we have those conversations, those sad ones, and we get through those depressed moments, and we see them approaching acceptance, we tell them, you can accept that this is happening, but we don't want you to accept this as your reality. This is something that we're working to change. Yes, this is the current state of affairs, but this is not something we're throwing in the towel and saying that this is what it is, this is who we are, this is all we will be, and we need to just do nothing. And that's, again, where the climate doom and gloom and anxiety comes into play. It's presenting it in a way where people understand the seriousness of the challenges, but they're also empowered to look beyond that gray cloud and see the sun that's behind it.
Wow, you have got to tell me about that three-year-old.
She is a very pleasant student in Abaco. I'm hoping to see her again soon.
Absolutely. Very good. All right. So we'll take our second break here of the show. This is University Drive. We'll have more after this.
Chapter One Bookstore is proud to serve the students, faculty, and staff of the University of the Bahamas and the community at large. We are the premier choice for the purchase of university textbooks and supplies and UB logo apparel, paraphernalia, and gifts. We also carry a wide variety of school supplies, learning aids, and leisure books. Visit our copy center for all of your printing, copying, and binding needs. Chapter One Bookstore is located on the ground floor of the Michael H. Eldon Complex on University Drive. Shop with us on Monday through Saturday. You can contact us at 397-2650 or email at chapter1@ub.edu.bs. Follow us on Facebook and Instagram at Chapter One Bookstore. Chapter One, the premier choice.
Welcome back to University Drive. We are talking about climate change, climate action, climate justice with Ashante Russell and Samira Ben Ali. And so we've focused a lot on the actions, the habits that need to change. But are there success stories? Are there things happening in parts of the world that we need to replicate? What are some of the successes that we need to pay attention to?
I guess in speaking specifically within the Caribbean, especially the Dutch Caribbean, again, I started off mentioning that this is one of the parts of the Caribbean that is not always acknowledged by the other Caribbean islands, largely in part because a lot of people really don't know that we have Dutch territories. And that's something we have had a specific desire to rectify and to ensure that they are included. So our Dutch countries, territories, they reside in both the European and Caribbean front, mainly because they belong to a kingdom. So one of the biggest things coming out of that engagement this year is us being able to host the first Caribbean Climate Justice Camp in St. Martin in February. In having this conversation, we were able to gather roughly 120 young people from across the region. So that is including the British territories, the American territories, the French, and the Spanish speaking countries included within that conversation. And we were actually able to convene. And that's the first time we've been able to actually meet as a region and have this particular dialogue. And we were able to learn so much about the realities of those within St. Martin and by extension, St. Martin, because again, this is both an island that has Dutch and French heritage within the same, within the same country. And we were able to get to the root of a lot of issues. And one of the biggest ones, again, was talking about colonialism and the red tape that it has really had within the region and in part played against us from really and truly connecting. Because again, similar to the Arkoi, us not being able to connect as much has been because of visa constraints, has been because one country cannot go to another one without having this paperwork, that paperwork, and the next paperwork. So being able to have just about all of the Caribbean countries, not all 33 identified, but became rather close within that space, and to have these conversations and to have partnerships come out of it, and to have arrangements and collaborations that we've forced well into next year. So our calendar is going to be really full up until next summer. But it was really and truly inspiring to see. And we've gone further in terms of trying now to connect with individuals from the Pacific again, and learning and seeing what they've done, because they have been the driving force of this particular campaign and understanding just how interconnected this issue is. And we understand that we have so much to learn from islanders within another ocean, because again, these issues are so similar between us. And instead of reinventing the wheel, which is something that we unfortunately do a lot in the Caribbean, because we do work in silos, for lack of a better word. And that's been one of the reasons things have not been as progressive. But within this generation, we are truly innovative. And as they sometimes call us, bullheaded or stubborn, which works in part, because we're not willing to accept nothing, and we're not willing to accept no when maybe our yes is an answer. So it's been a very eventful year, and it's something we really are proud of and looking forward to expand regionally.
For me personally, I think that I've been really amazed, not only this year, but so for several years. I feel like there is a real awakening, at least on the legal space, where people understand that actually states have obligations toward them. And if they don't fulfill those obligations in terms of climate justice, then I feel like people are feeling more and more empowered to go to court and actually reclaim those rights that they are being put aside by state action or inactions. For example, we have seen recently this year the Climat Sur Niorinen case, which is a group of old women who went to the European Court of Human Rights, who are Swiss women, saying basically that Swiss lack of action and lack of climate ambition has been infringing on their rights, in particular, their right for health. I've heard recently that someone from another French overseas territory, from Réunion Island, has also started to go to court because of France's lack of climate adaptation measure that is going to cause huge impacts on their islands in particular. For example, the cyclones that are starting to hit Réunion Island and that are going to get harder and more violent and more frequent are going to have an impact on their water systems. And now they have this time frame where they can actually do something about it before the worst happen, because we most likely know that it's going to happen in the next few years, but nothing is happening. So here, France is definitely lacking on their climate obligations. So I think that people are starting to understand more and more like state obligations towards them. And I'm really happy to see that there have been a lot of initiative, a lot of courageous people going to court, especially in territories where their rights are, you know, not being threatened on a personal level, where they maybe don't face as many risks. So I'm really glad to see that happen, and it's really encouraging, because that makes me understand that the work we're doing is actually going to serve people, and they're going to be able to use that in the future.
All right. What are the indicators that we need to pay attention to as citizens that would let us know if we are trending in the right direction, that we are turning the tide? I know carbon emissions is one, right? What are some other indicators that we need to pay attention to as citizens?
I think that maybe because also we are working on that intersection of human rights, I think that could be, if states put an emphasis on the fact that human rights are being impacted by climate change, and that thus it brings additional obligations for them, then I think that this is actually a really good indicator. But also, there have been more and more conversation around the notion of ecocide. So actually, I think that if states at all levels are able to acknowledge that they hold obligation also towards non-human entities, that is also actually a good acknowledgement that things are advancing in the right pace, because that will mean changing some of the frameworks that we have been working with right now, and also shifting some of the mindsets that we have had where it has been really extractivist, and it has been really trying to take as much as possible on the earth. But now with this, for example, being considered as a crime, then we'll maybe shift the kind of relation that we have with our environment.
Yeah, I definitely...
One second, Ashante. You use the word ecocide. Very interesting. Just tell us what the definition of that is.
So basically, ecocide, the word is constructed in two parts. So for eco, which basically means ecosystems, and side, which basically mean killing. And so ecocide would mean that there is a crime against the environment. If we do something that harm the environment, that harm our ecosystem, that harm or hurt in general, then that should be considered as a crime towards the environment. And then the environment will be considered as having legal personality. And so because you have like legal personality, we'll need to treat it as such and make sure that it's as protected as all other entity that have legal personality.
Understood. Ashante?
No, I definitely agree with that. A lot of the times we do not take into account the rights of ecosystems. We especially look at it as, we look at it through the lens of ownership rather than stewardship. And I think that is in one part been playing against countries for decades or centuries, really, because we don't have a holistic relationship with our environment. A lot of the time we look at it as an opportunity for us to gain. And the tragedy of the commons is something that is unfortunately too common. Especially when we can look right in our own backyards. Especially when we talk about the conch, because every single time there's certain peaks in the year where the harvesting is excessive. And especially when we talk about animals, resources that have closed seasons, we'll see a spike in harvesting right before or immediately after the season ends. And we have to, in part, reevaluate the ways we are approaching our environments and our ecosystems within our own backyard. Because globally, if individuals are observing us and seeing that we're not treating our environments with care, we're not advocating on the levels that we're making noise about globally, it sets a precedence that we're not as concerned about these things as we say. And that doesn't take away the fact that these challenges are still real and these crimes are still being committed internationally that are impacting the environment. But it's a double-edged sword, because in one part, we have animals that are suffering because of the rise in sea level, rise in temperature. And then we have another part of us harvesting them and over-harvesting them. So there is no intrinsic balance for these ecosystems and these environments. And unfortunately, they can't just jump out of the water and say stop. Unless we become the mouthpieces for these areas, these ecosystems, these environments, who will speak for them? Who will acknowledge them? Who will fight for them? And at the end of the day, if we lose them, we will pay the ultimate price. And can we truly be upset if that happens?
Yeah. And if I also may add something else that just came in my mind when you were talking, I think that one other good indicator will be if we change the way we also have our imagination of what a good life means. Mm-hmm. For example, I think that the way we have crafted what a good life is, it has been really led by a capitalist view of society and a capitalist view of life, where we actually demand a lot from ourselves. We give ourselves to, we're defined, for example, by our work, but what if actually we leave those definitions and we try to define ourselves by the relationship that we have with nature? So like even like reimagining the way we think a good life is, or reimagining also the way society work in a way that should be like more equal, and that should be based more on solidarity, more on community, those kind of thoughts could be also a good indicator that we're going in the right direction and that we're able to live peaceably with our ecosystems.
You both offer such thought-provoking comments and insights, and our time is rapidly winding down. Just one last question. Where do we go from here?
I think one of the best things we can do holistically and globally in terms of where we can go and what our next steps can be is addressing the gaps that exist within our specific backgrounds. For some of us, that might be education gaps. We are on the tip of a potentially life-changing decision. And with what comes with that is going to be a shift in mindset, a shift in practice, a shift in how we interact not only with each other globally, but with our environments. And that is going to bring with it some growing pains. A lot of individuals will not be as receptive, and it's not because they don't care. It's in part, they don't necessarily understand. So one of the main things that we need to begin to address is the gaps that exist in our backyards educationally and awareness-wise. And again, that boils down to looking at the ways in which we're presenting these challenges and also presenting the benefits alongside them. Because if you continuously hammer individuals with the good, the bad, the ugly, sometimes they only see the bad and the ugly. We have to be truly dual in the approaches in which we have these conversations. And again, ensuring that young people are included every step of the way, from policy drafting to policy revision. Young people have the right to represent not only their perspective, but stand in the balance for those that are too young to speak. Again, we have generations that are coming to be every day. There's a baby being born. That is the youngest member of an entirely new generation. And that child, unfortunately, cannot speak for themselves at this time. And it would be a complete disservice if when they come of age, there is no recollection of who their people were. If they lose ancestry, if they lose land, if they lose country and culture, it's us now addressing these gaps. So once this advisory opinion comes into play, and we are hoping for the favored response so that we can enact real and meaningful and binding, most importantly, change, we need to be willing and able to receive this and properly make use of it. So just addressing these gaps now and beginning to be more receptive to young people, especially if they come both respectively and full of innovation, allowing them the opportunity to speak and not shutting them out simply because of their age.
Yeah, I also completely agree with everything that you said. I think that's what we need to look for is definitely linked to education heavily. We need to make sure that people understand what is happening to them, but also what are the tools for them to be able to protect their rights and for be able to protect their land and for them to be able to protect their community. I think that other element of answer lies within the world of inclusion. We need to make sure that we are working, of course, cooperating at an international level with each other, but also working within our own community. And if we decide to work at an international level, we need to make it in a way that is where the people who are the most vulnerable are able to actually have a voice, whether those people are women, people of colors, people from indigenous backgrounds, workers, people with disabilities. We need to make sure that within the space that we evolve in, where we try to shift international law, then that those spaces are inclusive so that the laws that will come out of that or the policies that will come out of that will be a reflection of the realities of the people. That diversity should be like also a driving force. And that diversity also will make sure to include a diversity of knowledge. Again, I'm reiterating the fact that, for example, indigenous knowledges who so far have been able to protect a lot of the environment that we have left should, for example, be some of the kind of knowledges that we look forward to discussing.
All right, Ashante Russell, Samira Ben Ali, thank you so much for joining us here on University Drive. As we close, let's not forget the gravity of this moment. The world is watching, but more importantly, the world is acting, and that's whether by design or default. The future is ours to shape. Thank you for joining us on University Drive. Thank you, listeners, for listening in. Stay informed, stay engaged, and most importantly, stay hopeful. I'm Tamika Lundy, signing off for now.
University Drive is a production of the Office of University Relations at University of the Bahamas. All rights reserved.